The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning to you. 6 minutes past nine on this Thursday, the 5th of March 2026. And it's a dumping off all morning across the Northwest. You would know if you're in situ. But hopefully it's a little bit better if you're listening to us a bit further afield. Though the weather is going to improve for tomorrow and into the weekend, at least in terms of dryness and spring sunshine. And we're going to bring you plenty of sunshine over the course of the next hour and 54 minutes here on The Greg Hughes Show. So stick around if you want to get involved in the conversation, and lots of you do. And we really try and keep on top of all of the comments, and sometimes they slide into the next day, but we do try and read them all. They are not filtered in terms of importance. It's just the volume of them. It's really fantastic. So keep them coming into us. You can WhatsApp or text 086 60 25,000 or give us a call on 07491 25,000. And we've got a loyal band of viewers that watch us every single day. And we invite you to join that if that suits you. You can watch on YouTube, Highland Radio Ireland, which means you can watch on your smart TV, your Fire Stick, your Google streaming device, but also on your mobile devices as well, or your laptop. And we're also across Facebook and on the X platform. Thursday's a busy morning for papers because lots of them come out. Let's start with the locals. The Tyrconnell Tribune: panic buying as fuel prices soar. With the price of motor fuel and home heating oil predicted to increase by 30 cents a litre over the weekend, suppliers said that many households are bulking up their fuel tanks in what is panic buying. The big winner is the Exchequer. It's bonanza time for them. The government collects substantial revenue from fuel taxes, with excise and carbon tax on petrol and diesel generating approximately €2.73 billion annually. So just to break it down, John McAteer and the team have government taxes and levels is 50 to 55% of the product you buy. Produce and operating costs, that's 45 to 50%. So the raw material, and it's not the raw material, the refined material is, so if you pay €2 a litre at the pump, €1 of that's the actual cost of the petrol or diesel. Carbon tax makes up 17%. We'll make up 17%, but half of it is government tax. They could give us a break if they wanted to. Total excise receipts on fuel was $6.5 billion last year. That is set to increase dramatically as Donald Trump continues to bomb Iran. The Donegal News also taking a local angle on this international story. The Society of St. Vincent de Paul is bracing for a rise in requests for assistance as fuel costs surge across Donegal locally. The price of 500 litres of home heating oil has skyrocketed by over €200 in just a matter of days, while diesel is creeping close to €2 per litre at some filling stations. The increase seen at the pumps has been linked to the ongoing unrest in the Middle East. And remarkably, and I'm saying this tongue-in-cheek, and I know it's a very serious issue, the impact of that war in the Middle East, it depends on where you are in Donegal. If you're on the east, it's you're getting hit, right? But if you're in the west, you seem to be getting hammered. And in the south, you're also getting hammered as well. I'm not sure about the north of the county, but you would imagine if this is down to, solely down to the issues in the Middle East, that the price rises would be similar across the board. But we know they aren't. The Derry News' front story this morning: number of Crawford Square residents facing imminent homelessness. A significant number of tenants in rental accommodation in Derry's Crawford Square are facing imminent homelessness, having been served with notices to quit. The tenants currently living in the ten apartments contained within number 5 and 6 Crawford Street were told they had to leave their homes by St. Patrick's Day. A housing executive spokesperson said it had recently been made aware of the Crawford Square notice to quit situation. Worrying time for those people. Right, I'm in contact. Not everybody wants to come on air. We will be speaking to some people who successfully made it out of the Middle East on flights that eventually have been put on. But there's this crazy situation. Wouldn't you think if we were scheduling flights to bring people home that it would be free, wouldn't you? But we're charging them, and when I say we, I mean the government, €800, €800, beg your pardon. So a government charge of €800 for a seat on a charter flight from the Middle East has been described as a shakedown, not an evacuation. The government said it is bearing a portion of the cost for the Oman evacuation charter flight, but failed to answer questions about the scale of the contribution. The press release from Foreign Affairs Minister Helen McEntee announcing the evacuation flight tomorrow from Muscat, the capital of Oman, said it would benefit vulnerable citizens. But after details of the €800 cost for adult passengers emerged, Senator Patricia Stevenson said, "This is a shakedown, not an evacuation, so it's your money." Are you surprised that these flights that have been organised by the government to repatriate people, it's €800 a seat? Would you have expected it to be free? Maybe the people over there have the money and they just do anything to get home and that's fine. Or should we as a state be taking people home in these exceptional circumstances, free of charge? There are some people being in great distress, though. I've been in contact with a lady over there who has been watching flights come and go. They can't get a seat on them. And I was in contact with her this morning, and she was saying that they were told no flight was leaving Dubai Airport for Dublin for the next 2 days. So they got a flight from Dubai to Edinburgh. But now they've been offered one of those repatriation flights from Oman. €800 they've already paid. And Emirate reps then went to their hotel talking to all the stranded people, telling them that there would be the Oman flight available to them. But now the flight scheduled to go to Dublin after 2 p.m. today is full up. So the earliest they have an option for, and these Donegal people mad to get home, is Saturday. So what are you going to do? You know, it's a tough old time for people stuck out there. When will it end? Well, who's to say? The United States and the countries surrounding Iran are in a bit of a pickle, because Iran really, really quite cheaply can fire drones. Drones are what, 1 to 2 million? And some of the rockets they fire are a couple of million as well. And we don't know how many they have of them, but they seem to have plenty at this time. So they're able to fire hundreds and hundreds of rockets at a relatively low cost. The problem is in terms of defence, so, you know, the UAE and all the other countries around, it costs them a fortune, something like 12, 13, 14 million per rocket to intercept one of these cheap drones. And they're up to the billions now at this point. So the point being, what I'm trying to say is Iran's war is very cheap. Defending against what Iran is doing is costing that part of the world an absolute fortune. And I was also digging into the United States' supply of weapons, and it is really actually relatively quite small. And there is some suggestion that they could really exhaust their main supplies in a week or two of bombing in Iran, which leaves the United States very vulnerable. They're making a tiny amount of new rockets per year, and they're dumping them on Iran willy-nilly, and they can't replenish their supplies, which could leave the United States really quite vulnerable, or the Chinese or Russians could look on and go, well, if we decide to go into Taiwan, the Chinese for that matter, what can the US do about it? I think Donald Trump's painted himself into a terrible corner. That's not to mention the fact that, you know, we have to also consider there's an awful lot of innocent people being blown to bits as well, regardless of what your views are on, not regardless, but, you know, you might have views on the Iranian regime, and we can argue that back and forwards. There's no argument as to the death of thousands of people in a huge country, a population of 90 million. But it's going to play out quite interestingly, because if Iran can persist, if they can keep, don't forget Iran produces an awful lot of drones. They've been supplying Russia with drones to contest Ukraine. If they have an awful lot of them, watch on, because at the moment in the Middle East, they're able to defend. But as I said right at the beginning of this conversation, it's costing them by a factor of 5 to 6. It's cost to defend the skies. These drones, 1 or 2 million, the rockets intercept them, millions upon millions. I'll get the actual figures for you, because it's maybe something you hadn't thought of, but it all has to play out. And eventually, potentially eventually, Iran could have enough of these drones, have enough of these missiles to exhaust the defence systems of surrounding countries. And then what happens then? But anyway, the US-Israeli war on Iran spread to the Indian Ocean yesterday when a US submarine torpedoed an Iranian frigate off Sri Lanka, killing at least 87 people, and NATO air defences shot down an Iranian ballistic missile heading to Turkey. So we've talked a lot about the Middle East. There's people in Cyprus really quite worried as to what might happen there, the local people with family in Cyprus, and also Turkey is within range of Iran. Turkey, a NATO country. US officials said there would be no let-up in strikes, which they said had devastated Iran's ballistic missile program and its naval fleet. But has it? Right, let's switch tact, go to the Farmers Journal. And many of you out there in the farming industry looking at fertilizer prices, you know what happened when Russia invaded Ukraine. They went through the roof. Well, fertilizer sales have been put on pause this week in the wake of the ongoing conflict in the Middle East. Supply and price of urea-based products is the real concern among importers, some of which pulled price lists and existing quotations on Wednesday. Dairy Gold has told its members that sales of fertilizer will be paused for up to 14 days due to supply getting tight on the ground and very little coming in. Now, here's an interesting story from the Irish Daily Mail. Property developers are paying for an event in the French Riviera city of Cannes that will be attended by the Department of Housing to court institutional investors. The department is refusing to disclose the details of the sponsorship deal for the event next week or the one that was also held in Cannes last year. However, internal documents show officials expect costs of €300,000 for next year's event to be covered by private market sponsors. So, is it time maybe the families in defective concrete blocks, is it time maybe that you got a little fund together and hosted an event out in Cannes for the Department of Housing? Maybe that might speed up the appeals for those of you who are downgraded. Maybe it might speed up more flexibility into the scheme. Can you get together €300,000, €400,000, get a plane out to Cannes and wine and dine those from the Department of Housing? There's more Burks going to prison. Enoch's mum and sister have been jailed for 2 weeks. The mother and sister of jailed teacher Enoch Burke have been jailed for 2 weeks each over their behaviour in the High Court. Mr Justice Brian Cregan said the conduct of Martina Burke and Amy Burke in shouting and repeatedly interrupting a court hearing last month was a paradigmatic case of contempt of court. He added, They both know full well that they had no right of audience and no right to speak, yet they persisted in standing up in court and shouting and roaring at the top of their voices. They did so simultaneously and in a concerted manner. The judge was referring to a February 20th court sitting where proceedings had to be suspended and the two women were removed by Gardaí. Only two members of the Burke family were in the High Court for the judgment. Isaac Burke said his mother and sister were in work. Enoch Burke, who joined the hearing by video link from Castlereagh Prison, told the judge it was a fearful and nefarious judgment and told the judge there is a higher judge and he will account to God. So that's three Burkes in prison now. Amy, her mother, Anna, and also Enoch. And Isaac must have not been too disruptive yesterday, or he could have found himself in there as well. I'm looking at two very relieved people in front of me, Patricia Callahan. Good morning, Patricia. I can't hear you, actually. I don't know if... Hello? Yes, I have you now. And also beside you, Anna Callahan. Hi, Anna.
Hello, Greg. How are you?
I'm doing very good. Now, you're just back, Anna, from Dubai. As much as you're comfortable in telling us, you know, where were you? Were you there last Saturday and how the last number of days has unfolded for you?
Yeah. So I was at the gates waiting to board when the flight was cancelled and nobody knew why it was cancelled. And next thing, all the boards for every flight were showing cancellations. So it took a little while for the news to filter through that the airspace was closed. And basically, there was no information. And I guess it's unprecedented for airports, I guess, like, you know, experiencing these situations. So it took quite a number of hours before any information started to come through. And the first thing was that we had to start queuing for hotel vouchers. And that was a case of, you know, thousands, the whole airport queuing to get these hotel vouchers to be evacuated. And then you were spending the next few hours going back through passport control, through security, trying to get your bags. You know, you have thousands of people, you know, trying to queue up for things and eventually go outside. And we were bused then to different hotels. So you got on a bus and you didn't know where you were going. And basically, I had met a girl from Cavan on the at the gate, and we were both traveling individually. So we said we would stick together. And yeah, that's what we did for the last few days. And three other Irish people actually arrived at our hotel. So the five of us kind of spent the last 5 days together.
And you kind of found yourself near hotspots, didn't you? Initially close to the airport, which we know did come under attack. And then, or maybe it's from the same location, close to the US embassy, which also was struck or somewhere close to it. So you were fully aware of what was going on, I imagine.
Yeah, for sure. So when we got to the hotel initially to check in, everybody started getting these like really loud alerts on your phone saying that missiles are overhead, take cover, like stay away from doors and windows. So that was the first indication that we were actually under attack, let's say, or the country was, that there was missiles overhead. So we heard then it was around the time that the airport was hit. So that was about an hour after we had left. And in fact, it was the same gates that we had been at, the B gates. So it was quite surreal then to see the videos of where we'd just been had been hit. So that was the first, I suppose, indication. And then over the next few days, you were hearing overhead like constant bangs and interceptions, particularly Tuesday night. There was a number of missiles. It was literally as if it was like just above the hotel. And that was the night that the US consulate was hit, which made sense then because that's only 2 kilometres away from where we were staying.
How noisy is it when you're looking at, right, so we've seen the imagery, but you've seen it with your own eyes. And when you talk of bangs, is it like thunder or is it like fireworks or something in the distance? What's it like being under that?
I suppose there was kind of different noises. Like you would have very loud bangs that, to be honest, sounded like an explosion. Like I genuinely did sound like that. It wasn't like a soft thud. It would have been more significant. And then the missiles, to be honest, were more like planes, like really loud, like as if they were jet engines or something like that going overhead. And we knew that they weren't planes because there was no planes in the sky. You know, the airspace was closed. So the missiles sounded more like jet engines going across the sky, like rumble, like a really, really loud rumble.
All right, Patricia, what was it like? Good morning to you. Great to see you again. What was it like for you being here and watching on? I mean, obviously, I'm sure you had contact with Anna and she was able to reassure you, but mums are mums. So what was it like for you?
We had a very worrying weekend, Greg, I have to say. Really worried, especially watching all the news. We were watching the news constantly to see what was happening. We were able to be in touch with Anna at different times and we knew that she was okay, but at the same time, we didn't know for how long she was going to be okay, or we didn't know when she was going to get home. So it was a very, very worrying, very stressful weekend for us, a very stressful few days. So, you know, we're so glad now that she's home. We couldn't wait. Yesterday, we were waiting and waiting and waiting to get word that she'd actually got boarded on the flight. And then we were very nervous at the fact that she was going to be flying through the airspace. So as soon as I found out that the flight had taken off, I decided I'll have to get to Dublin now to meet her when she gets off. So,
and what was it like when you saw her coming through arrivals?
Oh, it was just I can't describe it. It was just wonderful to be able to put my arms around her and give her a big kiss.
Oh, lovely. Anna,
I have also said before, I have a daughter-in-law who's from Iran. She's actually living in the States with my son. But her family are all in Iran and we know them and we're very worried about them, praying for them every day. So just to keep them in mind as well, Anna's safe and sound. So we're very grateful for that.
Patricia, any news from them in Iran? I know there's contact blockouts and what have you, but is there anything getting out as to how they are?
Well, the last I heard yesterday evening was that they were safe and were staying indoors. So they're a wee bit away from, they're living in Shiraz, they're a bit away from Tehran, but at the same time, things do spread, so we just hope that they'll stay safe.
Isn't it bizarre that you had people in both spaces that you were concerned for? Anna, just a question your mother referenced there about departing, right? Because there is images out there of planes taking off and landing, and you can actually see rockets flying in the background. Airports have been targeted in the past. Were you nervous on the ground and particularly during ascent, or were you just relieved to be on your way home?
Very nervous, I'll be honest. So I suppose yesterday was a stressful day. So when we got up in the morning, we were actually told by the hotel that we had to check out. So that it was only 3 days of cover for accommodation and we needed to check out. So I was sitting with the other four people trying to figure out what our plan was. I got this text from the hotel to say an Emirates flight was leaving, and they contacted the hotel to tell me to go straight to the airport. So I packed up quick, and in the meantime, another of the party had got the same message. The two of us went to the airport, got through to the Dublin queue, and we had no booking message, we had no confirmation, we had no ticket. So we were queuing with everybody else for that flight, and hoping we, by the time we got to the top of the desk, the queue, sorry, that we would get a seat. So that was the first relief, and that's great. But then the relief turns to nervousness, because you're sitting waiting to take off in an airspace that has been very unsafe up to that point. And honestly, the plane would have been very nervous, that you wouldn't have had a lot of people particularly excited. We took off, and I think most people had the map, the navigation map, the flight path on their screens on the plane. And I think everybody was doing the same as me, keeping an eye on where we were and just kind of getting to about a 45-minute point or an hour point in.
Okay. Well, Anna, listen, I'm so pleased that you're home safe. The line just started to go again. That's not your fault. It just is what it is. And safe journey back to Donegal when it's the right time for you to do so. But for now, thank you very much. Thank you. Lovely to see and speak to you again, Patricia. And thank you so much, Anna, for joining us on the programme. Okay, that is Patricia Callaghan and Anna Callaghan, two very relieved parents, and a very relieved Anna there as well, no doubt. Now, yesterday, just in the interests of sort of balance and covering everything its entirety, we were speaking to the HSC about the €35 million+ spending plan for 2026 and the positivities surrounding that. And there are some in that, don't get me wrong. But unfortunately, it's just less than 24 hours later, we're reflecting on issues within the health service and certain decisions that seemingly don't make sense. I have a couple of guests to discuss this. Councillor Declan Meehan, who has condemned a decision to block the appointment of a consultant dermatologist at Letterkenny University Hospital. And this is going to leave patients facing journeys of up to 2.5 hours for treatment. Councillor Meehan, we've had a recommendation, haven't we, for a dedicated dermatology consultant for LUH, but now it's not going to happen. What's going on?
Yeah, so Greg, there was a review conducted into dermatology service provision across the Northwest. That review concluded, and the recommendation was that Letterkenny be given and resourced for one consultant post to do dermatology based in Letterkenny University Hospital. However, that was overruled by the National Clinical Lead in Dermatology, who cited reasons apparently that she felt that one standalone consultant providing the service would be inappropriate. Now, why is this an issue? It's an issue because the service that Donegal people have to travel to in Sligo is led by one standalone consultant. So, you know, this sounds a lot like hypocrisy and discrimination against Donegal. Dermatology is a key specialty that people need access to. They need access to a consultant, and preferably locally. We know that dermatology affects about 25% of the population. 2 to 3% of the population have serious dermatological conditions. And there's about 3,000 people a year in Donegal who will need to see or have a review appointment with a dermatology consultant. That means that under the current situation with dermatology provision in the Northwest, people are having to travel up to 2.5 hours in each direction to access that appointment at Sligo University Hospital. Now, if this was allowed to go through by the National Clinical Lead, it would not only be a better outcome, obviously, for patients based in Donegal, but also it would shorten waiting lists for people across the Northwest who are all currently accessing the same service based in Sligo.
No, for sure. This has an impact on Sligo patients as well, it has to be said, Sligo Leitrim as well. So we often, we are very good at hearing the reasons why. Very strong arguments, of course. A population well in excess now of 160,000, 1,800 patients in Donegal waiting for more than 6 months to see a dermatologist, and, you know, demand is there clearly. Have we been given a reason as to why that amount of people, that level of demand, doesn't justify a dermatologist, being placed into Letterkenny University Hospital at Donegal?
Not that I'm aware of, and certainly that information hasn't been given to me. The information was simply that the National Clinical Lead on Dermatology ruled it inappropriate that a single consultant would be operating in Letterkenny University Hospital. And again, that's despite the fact that that is the case currently in Sligo. This is just another example of health inequality faced by the people of Donegal. I've written to the Minister for Health and asked her to review and intervene on this particular appointment. Not only was it recommended that a consultant post be filled in Letterkenny University Hospital, the funding was actually secured. So this comes from the National Clinical Lead. There's National Clinical Leads who are professionals working in each specialty area. They're all Dublin-based, by and large. It's very easy to make a decision sitting in Talla University Hospital in Dublin when you don't understand or have the knowledge about the rurality.
But I think also it's time that these decisions, it's time that people were accountable for these decisions and give us the reasons as to why, and then we can have a more fulsome understanding and debate on it. It's not your fault. It's just this system that we have. Yeah. Stay where you are, because I want to introduce Dr. Kira Steele, a general practitioner who's with me as well, to discuss this. Thank you for your time. What's your take on where we're at and this decision?
Yeah, well, I agree with your synopsis that there's been a lot of good news in Letterkenny recently, but this certainly counteracts that. We're really disappointed in general practice for the patient perspective that they have a service deferred to Sligo. In fact, the developments in Letterkenny would sort of make it even more ridiculous that a dermatologist wouldn't support the minor surgery hub in Letterkenny, for example. You know, the patients we've witnessed in our campaign last year, we asked for a review of the dermatology service, and really two posts are needed in Letterkenny. And funding was allocated for one, and then there were barriers to that because of the logistics that Declan has mentioned. But from the patient perspective, having a service based 2.5 hours away is never going to be successful for them, for timely intervention, for cancers, for acne that causes scarring, for psoriasis, for light therapy that people need to go to on a regular basis. You know, it's just not acceptable to have to travel. And I was listening to your piece on the radio about, you know, this attitude that Donegal is always complaining. You know, there again, yeah, there's disparity. The reason is the disparity. You know, there's not equitable provision of healthcare because the service is always deferred to another county. I suppose that's the patient perspective, having to travel, needing timely intervention. You know, from the GP perspective, there's a lot of well-trained GPs clinically, and that really is led by demand. In the British Journal of General Practice, for example, you know, 8% of consultations, are based on dermatology. And of those consultations, 40% of the time is based up on dermatology alone. So there's a high clinical demand that was reflected in our campaign calling for that. And that was reflected in the clinical need identifying two consultants in Letterkenny. So also there's a training aspect to this. If we don't have a clinician as consultant dermatologist lead, we can't have specialist registrar trainees in Letterkenny. We can't have GPs on the rotation screen, on the GP rotation, training in dermatology in Letterkenny. And we know when there's an 8% presentation of consultations in primary care, we need GPs training in our local hospital to identify that in context. And again, then the fourth point I'd like to make is policy about Donegal is continuously being made in a centralised way, lacking context of the clinical picture and clinical need in the county for patients. We also, as GPs, create a meet demand by running minor surgery clinics. So there's a lot of really well trained GPs in the county who are seeing a lot of, you know, small cancers, removing these lesions. So actually the impact of that is underestimating the clinical need within the hospital, because a lot of that is dealt with in primary care. So devolving the service to Sligo will impact the Sligo patients adversely, and obviously, for those reasons that I've mentioned, adversely impact our patients here in Donegal.
Like, I have this image in my head of an individual or individuals taking about 30 seconds to make this decision, looking at a map, and seeing maybe where population centres are and looking at Donegal and thinking it's just a barren wasteland effectively, and that Sligo is the logical place to put these types of services. I hope it's not like that, but it feels like it very much well might be, Ciara.
Well, I feel that the rationale of the clinical lead needing two consultants, okay, that's an aspirational service provision. You know, that's probably his best practice, and I can understand that decision. But it's the adverse effects of that decision don't really balance the that benefit. Mm. I don't think. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Declan, and whatever way the decision was made, just to reiterate, it did go against a recommendation. I mean, that's there. It's in black and white.
Well, look at Greg, this is the frustration as well. And look at Ciara has articulated the need for this exceptionally well. But the frustrating thing is that if a review is to be conducted into dermatological service provision in the Northwest, and a recommendation is made that has ultimately been overruled or ignored, then what was the point in conducting the review in the first place? There's an awful lot of effort that goes in to these reviews and to these assessments. And I suppose that kind of speaks to the point of, you know, how these decisions are made. But when you have someone, as Ciara says, where these decisions are being made in a centralised way without any context on the ground, clinical or otherwise, that means
but surely that review should bring context to the decision.
Absolutely, it should. And I guess to go back to a point that you made, Greg, you know, I think we need further transparency and more transparency around how these decisions are made, and to make these in particular national clinical leads for various specialties accountable around how they make decisions, around what their reasoning for those decisions are, because at the end of the day, it is patients that are losing out.
Mm. Yeah, and Ciara, we talk about the 2.5-hour journey potentially for some, even longer for others. There's a subset of that, those that don't have the means to get there.
Yeah, I mean, I've had patients that just refuse to travel because they're too old, they have mobility issues. You know, they just are too uncomfortable, and you know, they just feel that they can't travel, and you know, that's reasonable. Other people aren't asked to travel 2.5 hours, you know, in other service provision areas on a regular basis, and it might be that they're traveling to Galway for, you know, urology. It might be that they're traveling to another appointment somewhere else down the country to access care, and you know, it's a huge travel burden on patients, it's a huge point. But just to say about the reports, there's been two HICWA reports, there's been an EY report, there's been a DP campaign led review of dermatology services, and there's been the Model 3 hospital report. Mm. So like, why are these reports being ignored?
Yeah, exactly. And that is the critical question. And in the absence of transparency over the decision-making process, we are left guessing. As always, Dr. Steele, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it. So you've made contact, Declan, with the Minister for Health. Maybe we have decent lines of communication. She does seem to be the type of person that can see if a decision is illogical, whatever influence you might be able to exercise in that regard. Of course, we've made contacts with our people as well. You would hope common sense would prevail. Again, here we are having to campaign and moan, in inverted commas, for equality, equity.
Yeah, look, Greg, I think that, you know, you're talking about all the positive news around Letterkenny University Hospital and the investment that we're going to see there over the coming years. And that is correct, and that's very welcome. But we had to fight tooth and nail for that. It wasn't given to us on a platter. It had to be fought for 4 years, involving multiple people, including clinicians, including public representatives, but also community campaigners who were patients with experience. So that hasn't arisen out of nowhere. That was fought for. And here we are again, having to highlight an issue, another example of health inequality in Donegal, and we'll continue to do that as and when they arise, because there's a real injustice as well as it being completely illogical. Again, you know, I feel like it's a double standard when they're saying that Letterkenny University Hospital can't have a standalone consultant for dermatology, and yet that's exactly what the service is in Sligo.
Okay, no logic to it. Thank you very much indeed, Independent Councillor Declan Meehan. And we were also joined on that topic by excellent GP, Dr. Keira Steele. David Murphy is with me in studio. David, thank you so much for calling up.
Thank you very much for having me.
You are setting up WAVES, and it's a support group for people impacted with moving disorders such as Parkinson's or a stroke, etc. Tell me a bit more about it.
Well, I've been diagnosed with Parkinson's myself for 14 years now, and it's kind of a wave of that I thought I'd set up a wee group for people to share their stories as well as myself, like, and reach out to people.
Now, you worked with your hands, didn't you? You were a skilled tradesperson, and you've been affected by a tremor and shake in your hand, and that eventually led to your diagnosis. Yes. So, traumatic time for you, David, I'm sure.
It's a big impact on people, like anybody's been stuck down with any illness, like, but with Parkinson's and people working with their hands and stuff, it's a lot more. But like, you just have to get on with it. Like, it's just, it brings in mental health as well, onto it as well. Like, people are diagnosed with any form of illness. Yeah. Like, mental health's a big issue on it too as well.
For sure. In Parkinson's and in the area of stroke as well, we know that. Now, there is a meeting taking place in the Everglades Hotel in Derry on Friday afternoon, tomorrow afternoon at 3 p.m. So what will happen within, or what happens within this WAVES community?
Well, there's just general people coming along. I think it's just a group of people hoping to come along and meet other people in the similar situations as you're in, like, and just general talk and have a cup of tea or whatever. Like, it's just, as I said, it's reaching out to people to help them on this journey. Like, when I was first diagnosed in 2014, like, I walked out that door of the consultants and I didn't know to turn right or left or run through the wall.
Amazing.
No
yeah.
help there at all. Yeah. So just...
So it's a, and this is what all support groups are, and this is why they're amazing. And it'll be, this conversation will be very relevant to those who understand what you're talking about.
Yes.
It's about shared experiences, what works, what avenues you can take, what might help, all of that type of stuff. And that only can come from, like, people in the same situation coming together.
This was all about. Like, it's out there that people have been diagnosed and don't know where to turn to, like, and where to go or anything else. Like, this way we set up this group. There were three of us started it off. Like, I'll never mention the name because I know who they are. And with the three, it's just... got going and started up. This last 2 weeks has just been hell for leather to getting it going and getting the
Brilliant.
Venue sorted out. And now there's six people on board now. There was only three.
Organising
yeah. and whatever else. Now there's six people in the group, and probably they'll maybe know somebody else. There's always somebody knows somebody that has some form of illness.
Yeah, now, obviously not everyone's going to be able to make it into Derry tomorrow afternoon. Just to remind listeners, it's in the Everglades Hotel at 3 p.m. This is also, there's a WhatsApp group as well, isn't there?
Yes,
or is that to be established yet?
Well, yes, the six of us on this WhatsApp group. So, like, if anybody's feeling a wee bit low, go into the WhatsApp. There's always somebody will talk, speak. Like, me and Les were on this morning day, 3:30, like, because we couldn't sleep, and we realised one another was on social media, so we could talk.
And you have lows, and it means there's someone there to...
Yes, if you're in a low, why it's called waves, it's like the ocean, like, if it's a rough day, you have big waves.
Yes.
If you have a rough day in your life and things are bad, then you have the low, like, nice calm. You're calm down. Knock on effect from it is just colossal. Like, I was told when I was diagnosed, like, I have it, but your family has to live with it.
Yeah.
You know, and people doesn't realise this. Like, the family is a big say in your life too as well. Like, and trying to keep you straight and narrow.
Mm. But sometimes it's good to, you need to speak outside the family and friends group as well.
That's the next thing I was going to say. Like, you can talk to your family to a certain extent, but you can talk to a stranger more than you can talk to your family.
Okay. Waves also, as you mentioned, the sea metaphor there, but it also stands for welcome, advocacy, values, empowerment and support. And it could grow into something really quite significant. It's already there, but you know what I mean. Now, David, if people can get along, they're welcome to the Everglades Hotel in Derry tomorrow afternoon at 3 p.m. And we have a contact number for you here as well.
Yes.
And you can speak to Caroline or Shannon there. You're happy for us to give that number out as well.
Anybody wants to. I should know short notice, like, because it's just
the
way things.
That's the way we work better at short notice sometimes, don't we?
The way things have worked out, and hopefully, all people will come along and join on in the future.
Yeah, and if not in person, and we encourage them to do so, maybe they want to hop onto that WhatsApp group or make connections other ways.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and how are you feeling now? Are you sort of steady on medication, David?
Medication, I have a thing called the Beach Band.
Right.
That's like a.
That's, it just looks like a watch, doesn't it?
It looks like a watch, but like it gets up there now on. If I switch it off, like, you'll see yourself.
Okay. Wow. That's amazing.
Like,
so it's presumably sending some sort of electrical signal?
It's electrical signal free. Like, I only wear it for a couple of hours in the morning, a couple of hours, because I don't want to get dependent on it.
Right.
But like, it's.
That's astonishing.
It's life changing, like,
isn't it? Just,
I know people that have got it and it's just stuck their life completely in a full circle.
Well, you see, there's one thing that people might not have been aware that even exists. Mm-hmm. You know, that's amazing how quickly that impacted
it's
you just, there.
It's instant how it works.
Brilliant.
Like, and I know several people.
Okay, I've never seen that. That's that, and for you to be able to demonstrate it as you did. Okay, listen, David, best of luck with Waves, and I'm sure the numbers will grow. Hopefully, there's a good turnout tomorrow evening, and we have your contact details if anyone will tomorrow afternoon.
We're not tomorrow, but maybe next month.
Hey, big oak, big oaks grow from little acorns, isn't that
what they say? Well, we get plants to seed before the tree can grow.
That's it. Okay, listen, thanks very much, David.
Thanks very much.
Look after yourself.
Andy.
A caller says, Greg asked Declan to apply for clinical leads decisions to be made available under Freedom of Information request to the HSC. Yes, indeed, of course. He and other councillors will be pursuing that, of course, as we will be also. Thank you very much for that. Greg, will our politicians now cancel the trips to America? What about our peacekeepers in the Lebanon? It's clear Israel's going to flatten it like they did Gaza. It is a concern. We're told at the moment by government that our soldiers out there are safe, but how safe? We shall see. Reverend Richard Kerr is moderator designate of the Presbyterian Church, and he joins us now. Good morning to you, Reverend. Thank you so much for your time.
Good morning, Greg, and it's good to be with you. Thank you for having me on your show this morning.
And it's great to have you on the show because as a person who grew up near Remelton, you will become the Presbyterian Church in Ireland's next moderator. What does this mean to you personally?
Well, first of all, may I say it's a huge honour. I'm deeply humbled too that my colleagues have chosen me for this role this year. A moderator of the Presbyterian Church is the first among equals. It's not for a long period, it's only for 1 year. So it's not like an archbishop or a bishop, but it is a fairly key role in our church and in our structures. And so it is a huge honour. And I recognise too that I'm coming into the church at a challenging time. I hope that I can help to lead well through this coming year. May I say just a little bit about my background in Donegal and just say how much that means to me. I'm a regular listener to Highland Radio whenever, especially when I'm up in Donegal, of course, and up to see my parents and family there. But whenever anywhere I travel in the world, and I have lived overseas for a number of years, I always tell people I'm from Donegal. It's part of who I am, and I'm very grateful for that. Also very grateful for the seeds and indeed the first steps of faith that I took growing up in a Christian home with my parents and committing my life to follow Christ as a young lad. And really, in many ways, this place that I've come to now is if you like, the next step on that journey of service that took me overseas to Malawi and Central Africa for a number of years with my wife and family, took me into ministry in the Presbyterian Church, as I am now in Temple Patrick. And this new step, a daunting step in many ways, something I don't feel prepared for or fully adequate for, but I'm looking forward to stepping into that. Yeah. And again, just coming back to the Donegal connection, I met somebody I was at school with just the other day in Belfast, and they came up to me and took my hand and said they were praying for me. And I'm deeply, deeply grateful for that. I'm grateful for the prayers of people right across the community as I step into this demanding role this coming year.
Yes, you worshipped in the Reformed Presbyterian Church in Milford. And even as a young person, as a teenager, and perhaps maybe not exactly what your peers were doing, you were a member of the Derry Donegal Christian Fellowship. What drew you to that as a teen, and what did you get from that?
Well, I guess I was very fortunate in growing up in a home. My parents were very deeply committed Christians. That was part of who they were. The church was very much part of our lives. But when I was about 12, I came to that point when I started to ask the questions, you know, is this a hand-me-down faith? Is this a faith that my parents have? What does this mean for me? Who am I? Mm. And I wrestled with that for a time, and I was a relatively young person. But I came to that point when I, if you like, I made an act of surrender, giving my life to Christ and asking him to come into my life, to take control, to be my saviour, but also to be, if you like, my Lord, the one that I followed, the one to whom I gave my allegiance throughout my life. And I have to say that you've mentioned two of the churches that I've been involved in, and both of those were incredibly formative in my years. The Reformed Presbyterian Church, huge emphasis on scripture, on the Bible, on learning that and understanding that and applying that. And that gave me a wonderful foundation as a child. I remember at primary school being in demand on quiz teams whenever we were looking at Bible knowledge, because my knowledge through my parents' teaching and my church connection was so good. And then the Derry Donegal Fellowship, something very different, but also at a key time, a formative time in my life as a teenager. It was the teaching, the sharing, the fellowship, learning how to be a disciple of Jesus, how to follow Jesus in practical ways, how to live that out, because I believe very strongly that faith must be lived. It's not just a head knowledge. And the friendships that I made through that are incredibly valuable, and I can't speak highly enough of that and how much I appreciate that.
I mean, obviously, there are very devout members of your church, of many churches, but part of the challenge, isn't it, going forward is, or maybe it's not, and maybe I'm not phrasing it correctly, is how do you make faith, how do you make church relevant or feel relevant or seem relevant to the next crop of young people who, as well as that too, though you found your own place in your faith, may not have had the influence that you had. So how do you make it relevant to the next generation of potential practicers, churchgoers?
Greg, that's an excellent question, and I think that is very key to who I am and who we must be as church and churches as we reach out to the next generation. Someone said that God has no grandchildren, just children, so every generation needs to encounter God for themselves. I believe that more than ever in a world where there's so much chaos and war, where people are just seeking meaning, direction, purpose in life, that the gospel, the good news that God loves you and I and each person to the extent that he sent his son into the world, that is still very relevant, absolutely key in our day and age. And it is fascinating to note that right across these islands, that people are, particularly young people, are coming back to churches. People are seeking that sort of meaning and purpose in life.
Do you know what I think they're also seeking, if you don't mind me, if you don't mind me interjecting, I think what people are seeking and young people are seeking now is guidance, rules, rights and wrongs. You know, like growing up as a teenager now, it's not easy, but I think it's harder than it was me growing up, because I knew Well, there was discipline, right? And I'm not talking about corporal punishment, but there was discipline, there was rules, there were freedoms, but those freedoms were earned. And now, you know, I think as a society, not just individually as parents, because parents have it tough as well, every path is really about, you know, no guardrails for teenagers, if you know what I mean. And I think we all need them. And I think particularly in our formative years, I don't think they're necessarily a bad thing. We can debate the rights and wrongs of what they are, but I think we've actually moved past that now to the point whereby we are almost, we're almost releasing 11, 12-year-olds into the world, you know, and maybe there is structures of school and what have you. But outside of that, it's like, well, whatever you want. We prefer things not to happen than have to say no. We prefer there to be no teenage discos than to say you can't go to the teenage disco. We prefer to see a ban on mobile phones rather than say you can't have a mobile phone yet. We want to see vapes banned because we aren't confident if we say you're not allowed to vape that they won't vape. And that's, I think we, generally speaking, inside, outside religion, we're not doing our young people a favour by struggling, I think, to guide them and discipline them and say, this is right, this is wrong, this is what that is, this is what this is.
Greg, I'm largely going to agree with you on that. I do think that structures are key. For me, I think it comes back primarily to the home. Yes, and I know that you're right, not everybody has had the privilege that I had, and maybe in my generation, where there were very clear structures in the home, and I'm grateful to my parents and for their support through the years and their continued prayers, because I know that even within a good home structure, sometimes things go wrong as well and are not what they might be, and people rebel against that. And I think the home can be too legalistic, because I think every one of us have to learn and experience and work through things ourselves. And I would say, even though I gave my life to Christ as a young person, I did things through my teens. I experimented with things. I tried things that, in hindsight, I regret. But that was part of growing up and part of learning. But I think the key thing for me is that home is a place of love and support, and that church is somewhere where we are provided with guidance and direction, and we come back to the centrality of Scripture, to the Bible, and there is a moral authority. It is just not a case that anything goes, but that there is a clear moral absolute in Scripture on what God wants for us that we seek to follow and live by. Mm-hmm. And I'm discovering that more and more people want to find out what that is and are seeking that kind of clarity in life.
One of your priorities will be, I'm sure, around concerns in terms of church failings in safeguardings. I think all churches have had issues with this, there's no doubt. I think some churches are at different stages of rebuilding trust. I think that would be a fair enough analysis of it. There's a lot of work, you could argue, in your church to be done yet in rebuilding broken trust. And that's actually with people who maybe have left the church because of frustrations or concerned with leadership, and then those that may choose not to enter the church because of these trust issues. So how do you, in your term, address that?
Greg, several things I would want to say briefly. First of all, what has happened in our denomination and in our central safeguarding systems, the failures there are totally unacceptable, and I want to apologise very, very clearly for that. While I was not personally involved, we as a church have failed. We have let people down, and I want to make very, very clear my apology to anyone who's been hurt or harmed by our failings as a denomination. There's no ifs or buts or maybes about that. That needs to be very clear. The next thing I'd say is that in my year in office, and I can speak for us as a church at this time, as a denomination, we are determined to address these things. We're already putting measures in place. We're setting up a state-of-the-art safeguarding department, a separate department that will be well-staffed, well-resourced, that will make sure that this does not happen again. And that is absolutely important. On a personal level, I have indicated already that I plan and I'm available to meet with victims of our failings through this year. And I hope that I can do that and I can reach out a hand to them and support them. The other thing I'd like to say finally, maybe on this, Greg, is that while these failings are central and they're unacceptable, and I'm really sorry about that, I want to say that at local level, in local churches and local congregations right across this island, the standard of safeguarding has been very, very high. Mm. And I know that in my own congregation. I know that from many others that where I've been talking to people. And I want to stress that. I want to say that our churches are a safe place for young people and adults to risk.
Yeah. And it's with those churches that trust has to be rebuilt as well, because they themselves would feel let down. We look forward to perhaps speaking to you again in the future. Congratulations on your appointment, and it's great to see someone with such strong Donegal connections doing so well. We're always proud in that regard. The Reverend Richard Kerr, Moderate Designate of the Presbyterian Church, thank you so much for your time and best wishes.
Greg, thank you so much.
Moya joins me on the programme now. Hi, Moya.
Good morning, Greg.
Thanks for joining us. You're in bad pain, aren't you?
I am in bad pain, yeah, with both knees now. It was just one knee at start, but my good knee has given. And I normally used to get injections into it. And once I got the injections, I was really flying. But it has put me on hold with all I do. As my walking, I love walking now, but it seems when I start walking, the knee is giving up, which is my good knee now that I was depending on.
And does it sort of feel weak? Does it lock up on you? Or is it just too painful, Moya?
It's just the pain goes right down, like a stabbing pain down the side of my knee. So it's definitely my knee is need doing. But the steroid injection used to be very good when I got them, or injections. So I got a few from my GP, which worked great. I was able to walk. I was able to do all my daily routine. Now I end up in the evening, I do maybe a 5-10 minute walk and I have to turn back. And then if I don't have the stick, I'm really done, which I never had to use.
Why have you not had these sort of, you know, life-changing injections since September? Because that's when the last injection was and you were getting very positive results with them. Why did they stop as far as you can determine?
Well, I did attend a doctor there lately and I had told him I was suffering with both knees now. And I just told him, you know, urgently, I really need something done to tie me over. I know I have to get an operation on my knee, but to tie me over now, I says, I need really something urgent. And he says, I'll take you in for injections. And I thought, well, the way he was on, that it was like when I was in an emergency, that I would have to get the injections, you know, straight away. Mm. So I waited maybe 2-3 weeks. I rang up and they told me that some of them services had been cancelled. And they told me, you know, the waiting list is there, but your name, there's no date. We can't give you a specific date. We don't know. I says, OK, I'll just ring, you know, the doctor's secretary. And she says, I'm really sorry. I took your file out. I put it on as urgent. But in the due course, the doctor hasn't been in day services doing these injections.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in a limbo. I don't know where I am. I'm just hobbling along. And it's just my life is put on hold at the moment. You know, my quality life.
Of course.
I used to enjoy my walk.
And if you can't get your steps in either, it's going to affect your general health. And of course, you know, if you're stuck in the house, it's going to affect your head health.
At night time now, if I sit and if I have to do this 10-minute walk to relieve my muscles, I use the bicycle, you know, but it's just sitting on a bike. I love when the weather's quite good to get out and do the walk. But then when I'm walking, maybe half mile, I'm just knackered.
Yeah.
So I have to stand a few times, but the injections used to help me. I could nearly walk around that place, you know, for maybe less than 10 minutes.
And can I ask how
now, nearly.
How long did the relief last per steroid injection? You know, how long did
it last me up to six to eight months.
Wow.
6 months now, my knees were brilliant.
And that was from one injection?
6 months. That was just one into one onto the bone on the left knee, yeah.
Is there
and
an option
for both knees?
Is there an option for you to get this done privately?
Well, the last thing I was told yesterday, and I think I'll need to go and do it, is just go to somewhere in Letterkenny that does private injections and just get it done, because other than that, I can't wait.
No.
You know, it's pointless even having medical cards now, because it's just like there's such a tailback and there's so many services being cancelled.
Mm. Mm.
And I understand there's so many on the waiting list and all that in front of me, I suppose, but it's just like it's like a throbbing toothache day in, day out. I can't even go on long distances because I feel I'm just knackered when the evening comes because I can hardly walk.
And of course, there's a cost associated with going private. I mean, lots of people are struggling. I'm not going to ask about your private life, Moya, but I hope you have the resources to get this relief if that's the road you go down.
Well, I have no option other than to go and do it because there's no such thing as help out there anymore. You know, you're just on your own and you just have to do it.
So just to be clear, Moya, you're on a public waiting list for a steroid injection, but it's going to be at least April. You're not on the list for March and even...
I'm not for the March list. I was told yesterday there's about 60 people waiting. And I says, is there any chance I could even get it in the next 2 weeks, you know?
Yeah.
And because I'm thinking March, you're going into St. Patrick's weekend, you're going into Easter. And I know everything's going to be kind of a shut down, you know, it's not going to be as busy. And she says to me, you know, no, definitely you're not on for the March, Moya. I'm sorry having to tell you that, but you're definitely not on for the March. And supposed the April list then comes, so I'm down as urgent, but I've been there on February.
Mm.
And February last year, I got one injection, but sure, I got another one in September. It worked brilliant, but sure, they don't seem to be giving them out now. I don't know, they keep telling you that the injections are not good for the bones, but they were very good to me anyway because I got back walking.
But you also have to.
The way I am now.
They have to look at the if there, maybe there is a negativity to it, but they have there has to be.
Yeah.
It has to be counterbalanced. What is the positives versus the negatives, especially if you're probably eventually going to have to get new knees? Moya, leave it with us and we'll throw it out to the listeners and see if anyone has any advice or recommendations or what have you, Moya. And of course, if you're not listening, I'm sure you will be, but we'll get back to you. And I do hope that it's so frustrating when the relief is there and so prolonged, actually, to get relief for 6 months with one injection. I just hope Moya gets sorted. We'll do what we can. Now, I received a contact from a listener, a really concerned tenant, they described themselves as, and it reads as follows. Hi, Greg. I'm a tenant in the defective council houses here in Buncrana. I've received a rent review form requesting all dependents' names and incomes in my household. If not returned, they've stated that rent will automatically be put up by €20. Can they actually do this? I've a window that cannot open as blocks have moved. There's cracks inside and now black mould is appearing in my daughter's room. I've requested that someone come out and review my house in person before putting up my rent. I've windows that cannot open, cracks outside and inside, and now the mould starting, as I mentioned, in my daughter's room. The amount spent on fuel to keep the house warm is ridiculous. It got even more ridiculous since I received this email. They go on to say, are tenants filling out these forms as I haven't? I've also had block testing done in the summer of 2022 and seemingly I'm not allowed the results as I'm only the tenant and they are the owner stroke landlord. They've said that they won't publicly give them to me. I feel my hands are tied. And we got in some photos which clearly demonstrate that this house is very much affected by defective concrete blocks. Councillor Ali Farron of the 100% Redress Party joins me on the programme now. And that's one person who's contacted me directly, Alan, one of many. And I'm sure it's the same with other people such as elected representatives. How can the council justify increasing rent for people who are in demonstrably defective homes?
Hard to know, to be honest. It's not something that we as a party have encouraged. We've been speaking up on behalf of social homes or people in social homes for a long while now. But it is what it is at the moment. Unfortunately, there's two sides to every story, unfortunately. And the first one is the council. The council houses, council stock, there is no scheme in place at the moment for them. And in truth, like at the end of the day, they're government property. It belongs to the government. They've given a scheme for private houses, but they have yet to give a scheme for social homes. Now,
That, Ali, if you don't mind, that's outside of the control of the council. That's a Department of Housing issue. What is within the control of the council is charging people more for being in crappy homes that are costing a fortune to heat and are cracked to their ears.
Yes. And, you know, whereas you want to blame me for putting up the rent for 20 euro, it never came in front of us as newly elected councillors. I'm told the last that it was a wee bit of research done. This was passed prior to us joining the council.
Yeah, I didn't say councillors.
We've raised this issue on several occasions that you can't expect people that are your tenants, like they are the tenants of the county council, living in houses that are not fit for purpose, for want of a better word. Like, we've all been in these houses. They're not getting any better. The mould, the windows, it's the same as every house. The windows are not able to open. So, yes, while I agree with you, Greg, you know, and the council, in some ways, are spending a lot of money to kind of semi-remediate. The estate in Mobile, they've spent a lot of money trying to seal up them cracks.
I know it's not your fault, by the way, and I never said it was, but if I was renting out a house and the bedrooms were growing black mould within them, the ability to open windows, which is a very severe fire hazard, it must be said, and I think the local authority would need to be very careful because they could find themselves in big bother if someone was unable to exit their property. And the house was letting in drafts, say, again, if I was a private landlord, I wouldn't have the balls, if I could put it so crudely, to go to a tenant and say, oh, by the way, I'm pushing up your rent, or threaten you with that. This is the local authority that is doing that. I know your party colleague, Thomas Sean Devine, has a motion down which addresses this directly. Can this MAD support my motion that the recent rent review being sent out to those living in social housing be put on hold until these homes are completely remediated? Do you think that will be... I mean, if it's passed by councillors, what might the executive do?
Probably the executive's on a hiding to nothing in some ways. They don't have the money to remediate these houses, and they are spending council money at the moment, you know, trying to tidy them up, but there's no guarantee that they're getting the money back from the exchequer. So while it is our council and we are responsible for trying our best to kind of manage that, the ultimate thing is that the scheme hasn't been delivered for Donegal. Like at the moment, there's 80 or 90 houses lying empty in Donegal that are defective concrete block houses, lying empty, and they're council stock.
Yeah, just go back, though. I just want to go back to the listeners, because my sympathy for the council doesn't extend as far as yours does, because this is a person who's facing a penalty of 20 euro, a penalty of 20 euro. They're in a defective concrete block house that the council own. that is letting in cold air, that they can't open the windows, and it's a fine, effectively, a penalty, a default penalty of €20 if they don't engage in a rent review with the council. That doesn't feel like that's got anything to do with foot dragging by the Department of Housing. That feels like people who are already in a very difficult situation finding themselves being further put in a more difficult situation by the local authority who just happens to be their landlord.
Well, the point that I'm getting at is that the council is in a very difficult position, Greg.
And I'll tell you one thing.
You have a nice smile there on your face.
No, because I'll tell you, you sitting there defending the council in this space was not on my bingo card for March, I'll be honest with you. But listen, you are probably right. You're in the council. If they're in a difficult situation, they're in a difficult situation, Ali. But continue, finally, just make that point one more time for us.
Well, like everything, everything has moved on. The cost of, and I'm no different to that lady there with the extra heating oil and the extra. And unfortunately, I don't want to ring my oil man this today because in the community centre, I have to buy extra oil. Everything has gone up. We get that. But the council have a lot more houses than defective homeowners, and they probably have to get in more rent. Rents nationwide have gone up. As I say, it's not something that came in front of my table since I became elected. So this was a decision made in 2023, I believe, to have a rent review, and this is the rent review happening.
Okay.
And I get it that, you know, if you're in a house that's not fit for... But the problem is the council do not have any extra houses at the moment that they can move them out.
Can I ask, will you be supporting Councillor Thomas Shaun's divine motion?
I'll not be asked because the letter.
Understand how it works. I presume it will be brought to a full council meeting. Will you be supporting his motion then?
Of course I will.
Okay.
You know, but the problem, I'm wearing two hats and it's not something you can do very, very easily. You know, from a council point of view, we need to get these houses restored.
Yes.
But from a council point of view, listening to the council staff who are trying their best to get a scheme. Remember, the scheme has to come from Dublin, and we still don't have one.
Yes,
so,
but there is rent reviews out there, but there is a very strong argument because there are, for example, if you've local property tax breaks for people in council houses. I would have thought there's a very strong argument, and only one real argument, that if you are affected by a house that has defective concrete and the council owns it, that your rent would be frozen until such time as the housing agency comes up with a scheme to remediate these houses. If you're not in a concrete block house, then of course you're going to be subjected to the annual rent review anyway, which effectively is, by the way, if you get an extra fiver from the state, the rent review takes that fiver off you. That's what it's about, really, effectively. But people in these houses specifically, if they were to have a rent freeze, the same way people in private houses get a break from the LPT, that would be something in a difficult situation. And I don't see two sides to that, but hey, you know, you're
but
a better
you
man
are,
than me.
Like, we've asked for that. Mm. We've asked for that in a prior motion, and we bring it up at defective block. But, you know, remember, we don't all sing off the same hymn sheet in that county council. So, and the people who have the most power in that county council are the ones that have the voice in the ears of government officials, and they're not delivering.
Okay. Ali Farron, thank you so much for your time. I do appreciate it. Look after yourself. That's Councillor Ali Farron there, 100% Redress Party.
Business Matters is brought to you by Print Supplies. Based in Frosses, Print Supplies has 21 years experience delivering managed print solutions that save you time and money. With remote monitoring and local hands-on support, they take the hassle out of printers and photocopiers. Email sales@printsupplies.ie to find out more.
Good ad, good voice that. I wonder, is that an in-house voice? Sounds good, doesn't he? Got a good voice, yeah, I like it. Very clear, to the point, Print Supplies, boom! Chris Ashmore, presenter of Highland Radio's Business Matters podcast. Let's start with some news. Tata Consultancy.
Yes, now many people aware of Tata Consultancy, massive firm globally. They employ over 1,000 people here, or around 1,000 people here in Donegal with what they have. It's called a global delivery centre based here in Letterkenny. They've won this distinction of being named as a top employer in Ireland. Now, this is pretty prestigious because it's the Top Employers Institute, which is a global authority which recognises workplace excellence. So you have to tick a lot of boxes to get this accolade, and that includes diversity and inclusion, talent acquisition, the work environment, well-being and learning. So bottom line, it's a good place to work.
I know we have an interest in wind output. It is energy creation. There are issues with that in terms of storing it when we need it and getting it into the grid, but still an interesting stat, Chris.
Yes, now it's been revealed that last month, February the 14th, in fact, was the day that there was a new all-time record for wind output in Ireland. And what was being produced was equivalent to 72% of electricity demand at the time. So that's a pretty high figure. And also, just in February, worth noting that we still imported 11.5% of our electricity. Mm-hmm. So
we're going to be more reliant on that. Yeah. We've yet to get the Spanish power coming in here, and we can call that green energy, can't we? Because it's all solar generated. Potentially good news, potential for more student accommodation coming online in Letterkenny. Big demand.
Yes, within the last few days, a planning permission granted to a company called Omega Fusion Limited. Now, it is subject to conditions, that's not unusual, for new student accommodation. It's just off the Remelton Road in Letterkenny, sort of in behind the Pulse nightclub, which many people will know. There is a four-storey block, which will have 30 bedrooms. Then there's a couple of three-storey blocks with six apartments in some of them and three in others. So that has been given the thumbs up from the council.
Business Enterprise Week's ongoing. We were chatting about this on Monday, and John Breslin has a show tomorrow morning from 11 o'clock in the Mount Errigal on site.
Yes, a great show. You'll have the leading artisan food and craft producers there, and it's a chance for people to go along, see what is being made in the county, and also to sample some of the great produce as well. Well worth getting along to that. As you mentioned, it'll be broadcast live with John. It all starts just after 11 o'clock, goes on to about 4 o'clock. So if you're in the area, well worth going into. And of course, the various other events continue throughout the week.
School meals, the school meals scheme. Some people are making some tidy cash.
Yeah, well, this is there's big money in the whole school meals scheme. I haven't got the calculator out, but I just noticed there's a tender out at the moment, Scolmoragh and Small in Letterkenny. And basically, they are going to provide a school meal, a hot meal, for 147 students on each day of the school year. And that contract is worth €250,000. So, you know, tasty. It's yeah. Tasty, all right.
Yeah. Tasty profits at Chadwick's, too.
Now, Chadwick's, they have a store here in Letterkenny, stores throughout the Northwest.
Is Screwfix part of that group?
No, they're I don't think Screwfix. Right? Okay. No. Now, Chadwick's are part of a group. It's the Grafton Group. Woody's would be probably the highest profile, although they're not in Donegal. But this group, they have recently acquired a firm in Spain as well. So it is a global group. The Grafton Group, as I say, includes Chadwick's and Letterkenny. Their pre-tax profits for the last year were £180 million. That is,
yeah,
actually.
And I think so. The Irish profits increase in Irish profits offset a bit of stagnant performance in Britain.
Yes,
and I'll move on now to the podcast, if that's all right, because who do you have on it?
Yeah, now I've been speaking to a finance expert, Dan Malone, about where to get the best return on your savings, just your typical current account, your deposit account, and don't be afraid to look at European banks. He's also been speaking about a new savings comparison website. So there are a lot of options out there for a better return.
You can find accounts in France, in Germany, in Spain, all across the EU, and a wide range of either fixed-term deposit accounts where you lock away your deposit for an agreed period of time in exchange for a guaranteed rate over that time, or an instant access account where you put your money in, you can withdraw whenever you like, and you get a much more competitive interest rate. Now, in terms of how competitive that rate is, we're looking at around 15 times the average Irish rate, so they are very, very strong. And as you say, it's all backed by the European Deposit Guarantee Scheme. So I think one of the biggest misconceptions about, you know, these digital non-Irish alternatives is that they're not as safe as the Irish banks. That's just not the case at all. European banking legislation requires that if you are operating as a bank in the EU, you have to adhere to the same safety regulations and you are covered by the same deposit guarantees. So that is €100,000 per bank per depositor, fully guaranteed by the state that regulates the bank. So
yeah, and we've an awful lot of money as a nation, albeit perhaps a small percentage of us on in the bank, but just sitting in low interest current accounts or no interest current accounts.
This is exactly the point that he's been making, in excess of $140 billion in these accounts. Now, a lot of them, the average interest rate on these accounts is 0.13%, so it's diddly squat. Now, some of the
bank charges will chew.
Yeah, absolutely. So some of the now it's not a huge amount, but some of the European banks you can get up to about 2.7%, 2.8%.
But it's the exit on that, you see, that's the problem as well. It's the exit, the dirt. I just was looking at something else. The government scheme, I think it's 120 grand cap. Whereby you're not taxed on that if someone's lucky enough to have that kind of...
Well, we may recall the old Charlie McCreevy in the SSIA scheme, which certainly a lot of people benefited from. Now, Dan Malone has also, in the podcast and on the show itself, there's a new website that he has set up. It's called honest.ie and it's a price comparison. There's over 200...
It's brilliant. It's about time all that was brought together because it can be confusing for people. Fantastic. So, listen, whether you have money or not, it will be an interesting year. Dan Malone is Chris Ashmore's guest on this week's Business Matters podcast. It's available for you to listen on demand very shortly and then scheduled for broadcast on Sunday, Chris.
That's right, on Sunday after the 6 o'clock news. And if you want to contact the programme, it's businessmatters@highlandradio.com.
Do you dare to dream? Premiership. I'm on about the Premiership.
Oh, dare to dream, yes.
Big night last night.
There was a bit of shouting last night.
Squeaky bums, they're really sort of, nervous.
Yeah.
And it's good to see, good for Arsenal fans to see all the teams falling by the wayside, but they're going to do it, aren't they? What would you moan hopefully. About then? Because Arsenal fans love to
You see, I think there's overreaction and a lot of fans are very fickle. Listen, there are twists and turns. Okay. I've seen it all before. But
you're not celebrating yet. Thanks, Chris. Chris Ashmore there.
Business Matters is brought to you by Print Supplies. Based in Frosses, Print Supplies has 21 years experience delivering managed print solutions that save you time and money. With remote monitoring and local hands-on support, they take the hassle out of printers and photocopiers. Email sales@printsupplies.ie to find out more.
And that's where that is where we leave it on the show today. We'll be back with you, all being well, tomorrow morning from 9 o'clock.